Well, I guess I lament the fact that I am on the radio and not television, because I hold in my hand a truly remarkable book which is full of unforgettable images, images which we, of course, can only talk about over the next few minutes. But I hope we'll be able to talk about them in such a way that you will want to run, not walk, to your local bookstore to pick up this book entitled Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer, by Peter Howe, who himself is a photojournalist and has been so for a long time. And this book is filled, however, not only with remarkable photographs, but also with really superb writing by Mr. Howe and by the photojournalists whose work is celebrated in these pages. We have Peter Howe with us for a few minutes to talk about his work and about this book. Peter Howe, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Give us a sense first, if you would, about your own career as a photojournalist and how you became a part of this world.
Well, I was a photojournalist for 13 years and then went on to be an editor, working for the New York Times Magazine and Life Magazine. But my experience with the combat that I photographed was two civil wars, Northern Ireland and El Salvador. And I must say that I was not one of nature's combat photographers. I totally hated being there. I thought people shooting at you was the worst possible bad manners you could imagine. And I just wanted to get out of there as soon as I got into there. The reason I did it, and I did it on several occasions, was because these were both important stories at the time. This was Northern Ireland during the 70s and El Salvador during the early 80s. And journalists like to cover important stories. But as a result of my experiences, I have a very high sense of regard and respect for those photographers who can do this time after time after time. And, you know, one of the photographers who is shooting today, still shooting wars, a guy called Patrick Chevelle, his first war that he covered was in 1967, the Six-Day War. Another photographer, Jim Narkwe, who has been doing it since 1981, is in Baghdad as we speak. So these are people who have committed themselves to recording these kind of events for a long period of time.
I want to talk through a couple of very thought-provoking things you say in the book's introduction. One of them being when you say, combat is arguably the most intense experience a human being can endure, whether as a soldier or as a photographer. And then you go on to say it is also one of the most complex.
Mm-hmm.
In what way is it important for us to know that combat is complex? And what does that have to do with the work of the war photographer?
Combat is complex in as much as it is, it produces a whole maelstrom of emotions and experiences and sensations. War is, even well-organized wars, are absolutely chaotic. Excuse me. I was in absolutely no, it didn't surprise me at all that looting broke out in Baghdad and other places, because war is chaos and that sort of activity is a part of chaos. But you will get, at the same time, you will be terrified, you will be excited, you'll be moved, you'll be angry. It is an incredible sort of multi-layered sandwich of emotions that you feel. The other thing I think about combat is that it is one of those experiences that, unless you've been in it, you actually cannot fully understand it, because it is, you cannot refer to anything else that's like it, and as a result, I think you get people who've been in combat tend to identify very closely with other people who've been in combat, whether it's photographer to photographer, or soldier to soldier, or soldier to photographer. And I think one of the things that you know, when we were talking about the photographers undergoing combat training to be embedded with the units that they're working on now, that the idea behind the Pentagon was that they would bond with the with those units, bond with the people that they were working next to, and as a result would kind of ameliorate the kind of coverage that they gave. I think one of the things that they didn't take into consideration is that photographers do have often a very high sense of relationship with fighters. They do understand and bond with the fighters that they're working alongside of.
You mentioned, speaking of bonds, that the fact that there is a very important camaraderie amongst photojournalists, war photojournalists, but there it is also a very competitive profession, and I am intrigued by the paradox.
Well, photography itself, I mean, journalism itself, as you well know, is a very competitive profession, and normal journalism, you know, if you're a photojournalist working on a story normally, you want to be there first and you want to be there alone, and that way you get the pictures. I used to shoot for a French press agency, and every time I sent the pictures in, they would say, is it exclusive? And if it was exclusive, then you could probably get some more money than you were going to. In combat situations, the difference is that photographers work together, and you will often see a photographer from Time and a photographer from Newsweek shooting in exactly the same location. They do that because there really is safety in numbers, and you really do need to be able to have people who know who you are, where you're from, who you're representing. It's really a safety factor.
When you talk about survival for the modern combat photographer, you say that staying alive means not only avoiding death from mines, mortar shells, machine gun fire, but also it means finding food to eat, a place to sleep, going without running water. Yeah, I had not stopped to think about that. I think we all are at least somewhat aware of the sort of immediate peril that all combat photographers face, but I'd not stop to think about just the factor of living conditions, which can make such a difference.
Yeah, if you're in a place like Chechnya, you know, there's hardly any running water. There are no hotels. There are no restaurants. Very limited food supply, and just the process of staying alive is a challenge. And you know, I asked one of the photographers, "What is it you pack to go away to, you know, when you go out on a mission such as that?" And actually, the last thing, the least important thing that you pack when you're going away are clothes. Clothes you don't care about because, you know, you may smell absolutely vile by the time you get back, but it's not going to imperil your actual survival. What you take is you will take a water purification unit, you will take a shortwave radio, you will take some form, as much as you can, of nutrition that is transportable and can be preserved for a long period of time. And, you know, even electricity, one of the biggest challenges that a lot of photographers have nowadays, you know, they're shooting with digital cameras, they're hooking up to laptop computers and transmitting via satellite phones. All of these require electricity to be able to work. And often, you know, if you're in the middle of the desert in Afghanistan, you don't have a supply of electricity readily available. And there was an interesting, during the war against the Taliban, there was an interesting convergence of new technology and ancient technology in as much as some of the photographers were bringing gasoline and generators across the mountains on the backs of horses. And so their technology was dependent upon the oldest technology in the world.
We're speaking with Peter Howe, responsible for an incredible book entitled Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer. Peter Howe himself was and is a photojournalist. In your chapter entitled For Every War, a Witness, you give us a brief sketch of the history of war photography, which essentially dates back to the Crimean War. One of the interesting points you make is that by the First World War, technology changed in terms of lenses and film fast enough that the whole mission of a combat photographer really changed, and what they could capture, the kind of images they could capture, really changed. Explain why that was so dramatic, that sort of shift in technology.
Well, the first war, as you rightly said, was the Crimean War, which was between 1854 and 1856. And the technology available to photographers at that time was so static that you were using huge cameras. You were using a thing called wet collodion process, which you didn't have film that you could transport. You transported chemicals. basically all you could do, you couldn't really photograph war. You could photograph the soldiers before they went to war and then their bodies and the battlefields afterwards. As the technology developed, it enabled photographers to get closer to the action. As you rightly say, the First World War was really the first war where this was available, but the significant breakthrough which allowed photographers to provide the sort of combat photography we're used to seeing now was the invention of the Leica in 1925. And when that was invented, you could carry a couple of bodies, some lenses, and a supply film on your body, just in pockets around your body. And so it gave them much, much greater mobility. And really the first war that was photographed in that way was probably the Spanish Civil War.
Hmm. So you say at that point, war photographers became combat photographers.
That's
because
right.
You weren't just photographing the aftermath of battle, but could actually capture images of the battle itself.
That's absolutely right, and that's really the distinction between, I mean, all combat photographers are war photographers, but not all war photographers have been combat photographers because of the limitations of technology.
Right. And it's interesting to think about how, for instance, Matthew Brady captures remarkable images from the Civil War, but essentially none of the heat of battle. And so, in a sense, he was never facing the peril that his modern-day counterparts face.
Well, he was certainly facing the peril. He just couldn't photograph it. I mean, he was within range, he and the photographers who worked for him, they were within range of frequently of the battle. But also, you know, battles, the technology of war has changed as well. At the First Battle of Bull Run, wealthy Washingtonians actually went in carriages with champagne picnics to watch the battle because the battle itself was so contained that you could do that with little or no risk to yourself. Nowadays, of course, and particularly in civil wars, one of the distinctions between a civil war and a more conventional war is that the war is everywhere. You can never get away from it. The targets are just as much civilians as they are military personnel. In fact, more often than not, they're more the targets than military personnel.
Yes, you say warfare has always been chaotic, but there were always lines of demarcation and the opportunity to leave and rejoin the areas they defined. And now the lines have been eradicated, and along with them, any sense of security or escape.
That's absolutely right. I mean, during the First World War, you could leave the lines and literally within 10 or 20 miles, you could be sitting down and having dinner in a very nice French or Belgian restaurant. Nowadays, as I said, one of the conflicts that I covered was Northern Ireland. And there's in each of these conflicts, there's always a hotel that the press use. You know, we've been hearing a lot of talk about the Palestine Hotel in Beirut, in Baghdad. In Northern Ireland, it was a hotel called the Europa, which at one point had the dubious distinction of being the most bombed hotel in the world.
You mentioned the fact that as the power of the camera, still or video, is more widely understood, its operator becomes a target, both in firefights and while traveling around the country. In other words, as we begin to fully appreciate the difference which journalists and their work can make, then they are in still greater danger because there will be people that will want to end that work.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, when you look at the shelling of the Palestine Hotel, or the fact that Al Jazeera's offices were bombed both in the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan and also here. I mean, I think that whether or not there is any deliberate attempt to target journalists, and, you know, I think that we can get a little paranoid about this if we're not careful, but the fact is that photographers and videographers do provide information which a lot of people don't want to get out there.
We are speaking with Peter Howe, the author of Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer. As fascinating as the introductory pages of this book are, the heart and soul of it, of course, are as we meet a series of war photojournalists and see their work and hear from them. And there are 10 of them in all. How did you choose these particular 10 photojournalists?
Well, I knew 8 of them. I knew them quite well, both, you know, as being a photographer and also in my role as an editor at the New York Times and at Life. The ninth I didn't know, but I knew of her reputation. And the tenth, a photographer called Lauren van der Stock, I didn't know at all. But when a friend of mine who knew I was doing this book said, you know, you should really talk to this guy, in particular because he had literally just been wounded very severely in Israel on the West Bank. And in fact, it was actually the second time that he had been wounded during his career.
Hmm. One of the things that I find very striking is that these photojournalists who are so adept with a camera in capturing photographic images are also wordsmiths of the highest order. I mean, they express themselves so superbly well.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's always been this idea that, you know, photographers are sort of barely domesticated animals, where in fact, actually all of these guys, you know, they're, for the most part, I think they're mostly college graduates, not all of them, but mostly. But they're smart, articulate people. And that was another thing that I wanted the reader to take from this, to hopefully they would share my respect for these people. Because these are not adrenaline-crazed cowboys. These are people who know exactly what they're doing, know exactly why they're doing it, know the risks that they're taking, and for whom I think society really has a debt.
I am particularly struck by some of the words of Philip Jones Griffiths, a Welsh-born war photographer, whose work is in this page, the pages of the book. At one point he says he believes one of the great benefits of being a photographer is that you are there and you see with your own eyes, you hear things, you discover things, and sure enough, you learn. That is the whole point. And he goes on to say it was almost worth doing the work, that is, without film in the camera. The idea that just being an observer for these incredible scenes, that in itself was of extraordinary importance.
Yeah, that's, I think, a theme that's echoed by several of the photographers. There's a photographer, Ron Haviv, who says that to see history unfolding in front of your camera is a privilege. And, you know, I think that one of the very, very strong motivations for all of them is the feeling that what they are doing is important. And all of us, you know, like to think that what we are doing is important. These guys unquestionably know that what they're doing is important. Important on two levels. It's important that we have this information as it occurs, but it's also important that we keep these images within our collective memory bank so that as a society, when we have to make decisions as to whether or not we should be involved in the next conflict, the next war, those images will be part of the process that we incorporate before making decisions which are as cataclysmic as saying we will go to war. Hmm.
Something else Mr. Griffith says, which I think is quite intriguing, he says at one point, "I am a doubting Thomas, someone who does not believe anything that he's told. I'm going to find out for myself. Mm-hmm. That is the main reason for doing what I do." Do you think that's something that most serious journalists share in common?
Yeah, I don't think you can be a journalist of any sort without having an overwhelming a sense of curiosity. I mean, it is a mindset that you have to have. And also, I think a fair degree of the same kind of doubting Thomas quality that he alludes to. And one of the things I think is most valuable about still photography is it can cut through a lot of the euphemisms that have particularly been associated with war. If you see bodies of dead children in their snowsuits in a morgue in Sarajevo, that's collateral damage. If you see photographs of soldiers in agony, that may be the result of friendly fire. So these bland kind of titles that we put upon violent actions are cut through by the power of the image.
In the chapter devoted to Ron Haviv, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, one of the things he says is that he finds himself motivated by two different reasons or purposes. One, very selfish, he says, to just be at a place where history is being made and unfolding. But then the second is the idea that a photographer can help protect people and give voice for people who have no other way of speaking.
That's right. And it's interesting that his work out of the Balkan conflict was used by the International War Crimes Tribunal as part of the evidence that they were assembling to prosecute several of the Serbian war criminals, prosecutions that are underway at this moment. So, you know, even on a very practical level, this act of witness has an immense amount of value.
He talks at one point in such a striking way about how in 1994 and in 1991, he essentially took the same photograph of a poor refugee woman. It was a different woman. It was a different part of the country. But it was the same exact picture. And he laments the fact that a given publisher might say, ah, you know, we've seen this picture before, this kind of picture. But he says, but the whole point was that it was the same picture. In other words, the same suffering playing out again
and again.
That's
absolutely right. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in a society and a culture which has a very short attention span. And so those, you know, that kind of making that distinction is something that isn't very interesting to us quite often, and as a result of which we lose the value of the lessons of history. And, you know, that whole saying about those who ignore history will be forced to repeat its mistakes, I think is very relevant here.
I am also struck in his chapter as he talks about two different photographs in which he is essentially shooting images of two different men under different circumstances who are about to die. One, a young Muslim who has just been captured by Serbian paramilitaries, and he has been forced on his knees, and he is soon to lose his life. And in another case, someone in essentially down in a ditch who has been shot and is bleeding to death. And he talks about how it is such a powerful experience and one that a photographer never forgets.
That's
to be
right.
Capturing those kind of images. I was struck that even when this is one's life's work, that that a photojournalist is very powerfully and permanently affected all the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, there are so many ethical considerations that come into play, which ethical decisions that have to be made. You know, do you intrude? When do you intrude? How do you intrude? You know, photographing a man who's dying in front of you, what could be more intimate than that, or intrusive? But the reality is that these are images, I think, that in some ways make sure that that individual man's death was not in vain. And, of course, there is nothing that you can do to alter that. The one of the Muslim men who'd been captured by the Serbians, you know, Ron couldn't have done anything to alter what was happening to that man and what would eventually happen to him, which is he was thrown out of a window. But he could at least record that this did happen. And one of the real values, I think, of this work is that it gives the lie to revisionist historians that something didn't happen or that something was exaggerated. Because it gives us clear and unequivocal proof that it did.
In the chapter devoted to photographer Don McCullen, who I think is British, if I remember correctly, there is the story he tells of a Vietnamese soldier who has been killed, and he's actually posed this photograph, and in the foreground of the picture, just in front of the corpse, are some of the personal belongings of this dead soldier.
Yeah.
Laid out to capture not only the corpse, but some sense of the life which has just ended.
That's right. And he, you know, has always been totally upfront about the fact that this was a posed picture. And the reason for doing it was that as he saw the contents of the pockets of this dead Vietnamese soldier, he was looking at girlfriends that he wouldn't return to, a mother he wouldn't return to, all of the trappings of a life, and that this corpse was a human being. This was not something that you know, as he came across him as a corpse, but he was a man who had a life, and that was how he wanted to illustrate this man's life.
It's interesting, too, there are a few disturbing stories in the pages of this book in which an enemy soldier, if you will be shot and killed, and then the treatment of the corpse by those who have killed the soldier in question. Photographers, for all the connection that they might feel with the troops with which they are traveling, are sometimes in the position of recounting human beings at less than their best.
Absolutely. Well, you know, war brings out the worst of people as well as the best of people. And what motivated Don McCullen to do that photograph that we just spoke about was that it was at the Battle of Hue, and he got up one morning, went out, and saw that there were many corpses near where he'd spent overnight, and their bodies were being looted by U.S. soldiers. And, you know, looting is something that happens in every single war. It does bring out our worst qualities, although can bring out some of the best qualities as well.
One of the other photographers, James Nachtwey, or Nachtwey,
mm-hmm. Nachtwey.
He says at one point, it is not easy to witness another human being's suffering. There is a deep sense of guilt, not that I caused the situation, but that I am going to leave it. At some mm-hmm. point, my work will be finished, and if I'm lucky, I'm going to get on an airplane and leave.
That's
they
right.
are not.
I think everyone feels like that you go in, you do your work, you leave, you go back to your comfortable and privileged life, and the story doesn't end when you leave. The story continues and will continue it certainly has continued as long as we've had human society, and probably will continue for a while to come.
There are difficult images to see in this book, but I get the sense that you wanted to just choose those images that were so powerful, even those that are really painful for us to see.
Let me tell you, I left out a lot which were even more painful. And because one of the things you have to do is to try and select images which are appropriate to the situation that can communicate to the reader without repelling the reader. And that's very difficult sometimes.
The book is Shooting Under Fire, The World of the War Photographer by Peter Howe, published by Artisan. And Mr. Howe, a great pleasure talking with you today on the
Thank
Morning
you.
Show.
It's been a pleasure to be here.